And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow, Saturday, the 20th of May, the University of Wisconsin-Parkside is hosting an all-day film showcase event in the Rita Talent Pickens Center for the Arts and Humanities. The event, titled Cinema Showcase at Parkside, is going to feature the screening of short films created and directed by local high school and college-age filmmakers. It's an event that is free and open to the public. And the showcase is going to conclude with a 6:30 p.m. screening of a full-length documentary film titled Messwood by up-and-coming filmmaker Emily Kuster. The film Messwood tells the story of a highly unlikely partnership between two high schools dramatically different from one another. Shorewood High School, a mostly white public school in one of Milwaukee's most affluent suburbs, and Messmer High School, a largely black Catholic school, most of their students coming from the central city, many of them from low-income families. Back in 2001, Shorewood High School was finding it increasingly difficult to field a legitimate football team. Fewer and fewer students were going out for football, and the program was struggling terribly. Messmer High School, on the other hand, had no football program whatsoever. Back in the 1980s, the diocese had actually closed Messmer High School for a time before it was reopened at the urging of parents. But by that point, football had been eliminated altogether from Messmer because of budgetary constraints. So in 2001, Messmer High School had some students interested in football, but no football program and nothing in the way of equipment, not so much as a single chin strap. Thus was born this intriguing idea of these two schools combining forces with a combined football team. It was the first football partnership in the state of Wisconsin to involve a private school and a public school. And across the country, it was the only partnership to involve two such widely divergent schools, so different from one another. Greg Borowski, at the time a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and a graduate of Messmer High School, was so intrigued by what was happening that he undertook to follow the first season of this combined football team. And he did so with the blessing of his paper and was able to ultimately write a fascinating book about it called First and Long, A Black School, A White School, and Their Season of Dreams, published by Badger Books. The book was published in 2004, and shortly thereafter, Greg Borowski was kind enough to come down to our WGTD studios to talk about the book and about this amazing experience with these young athletes and their coach, Jim Trost, through that first season as Messwood, the combined football team of Shorewood High School and Messmer High School. So in honor of the screening of this film, Messwood, which takes this story up to the present day, here is a portion of my conversation with Greg Borowski. At one point, I asked him in the interview about the amazing access he was granted. He attended approximately 90% of the practices of that football team and, of course, was also on hand for every one of their games. I talked to him about how he was able to gain that kind of access.
Well, I had the idea to, my vision from the start was to do a story that followed the players and the coaches on the field and off and really explored the season in a narrative fashion. I've written over the years several stories that would be considered narrative nonfiction, where the approach is you really immerse yourself into the story and present it to readers, not in a typical newspaper fashion, but in the same way as if you were reading it, you'd think maybe you picked up a novel or a short story, so that there's storylines and narrative themes that follow throughout the season, and it's you don't view the people you're interviewing as sources as much as they're sort of a character in this story and this larger drama going on. So I went early on to the administrators on both sides and got them to told them what I was wanting to do, and they agreed to do it, and the coaches did, and said, the head coach said, he was on board right away. I think they all saw this as a good story and an important one, and said, you know, you're going to see everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And
boy, you did, didn't you?
Yeah, and I am very appreciative that they all kept that commitment alive, because there were various points in the season when some of them may have said, you know, I don't know if it's such a great idea to have a reporter hanging out here. But what I did was, on the first day of the team meeting, the coach introduced me, and I talked very briefly with the players and told them what I was intending to do. And said to them at the time, I said, hopefully, I mean, I'm going to do some interviews with you, but for the most part, I want to just observe the season and to just watch what happens, as opposed to, you know, we weren't writing stories after every game or doing anything that would, you know, sort of change the direction or tenor of the season. I want it to be sort of the ultimate fly on the wall and see what happens. And yet the deadline constraints meant that I had to conduct a lot of interviews during the season as well. So it was a matter of, you know, picking out a group of players that became sort of the core group focused on in the story and subsequently in the book. But, you know, just talking with them about their perceptions, trying to do it in a way where it didn't interfere with them on the playing field or what they were going through, but to really just usually after practice or during a, you know, between the two-a-day sessions, and you know, interview somebody. And it took a lot of interviews in some cases to get the players to open up to the degree they did. A few were very open right from the get-go and said, you know, here's my background. You know, one of the players who didn't make it through the entire season but made it for several games had been kicked out of his earlier school for dealing drugs, and he was very upfront with that. And that background was really so different than the Shorewood side that once they explored it as a team at a team, you know, bonding session, I think they all you know, got a better understanding of the others.
How much did you know about football going into this?
Well, as much as a casual fan who watches NFL football on Sundays does. I didn't play football myself. I at various points, the coaches at Messmer were like, you know, anytime you have a able-bodied player, they sort of see you in the hallways and try to get you to play. And early on there, my parents were convinced I would be injured if I was going to play, and then kind of gave me the go-ahead to play as a junior. But our family was on vacation that summer for several weeks in August, so I would have missed the beginning part of the practices. So I didn't go out just for that reason. And but as a fan, it's, you know, you can see it and you follow it, but to deal with the coaches and the plays and really see it up close and how it has to come together, it gives you certainly a new appreciation for the complexity involved, the various assignments on a play. How at one point early on in the book, I do the comparison that, you know, everybody on the football team has to meet their assignment on every play, and sometimes the play, there may be a dozen ways in which the play can go wrong, but only one way if it's going to be successful, and that is everybody has to fulfill their assignment and do it well, and that's sort of the ultimate measure of teamwork.
One thing, of course, that was interesting as this team first assembled in the summer, in those very hot summer months, is that from day to day, the number of players that would be there would be different. 33 the first day, 26 the second day. I mean, in and out and in and out, which, of course, was a very frustrating thing for the coaching staff. And it was partly, but I don't think entirely, a phenomenon from these Messmer students who really did not understand the discipline that is involved in being part of something like a football team. They came to the table with all kinds of natural ability, perhaps, but not understanding how a team like this really functions.
Right. That phenomena existed on both sides, but in large part there were students, you know, from both schools who thought, well, this is a great idea. Now we're going to have a great team, and let's go out and we're going to play and be very successful. And the expectations at the beginning of the season were exceptionally high. The, you know, to a person, almost, if you had told, I mean, they were going to win games, they were going to go to the championships, they were going to go to the playoffs and do all these great things. And some of that came from the idea that, you know, they played football on the playground, or they played it in the park, or you know, maybe they played it in eighth grade in a youth league or something, and just thought, well, that's going to translate into this great success. And when it didn't, immediately many of the players, you know, dropped out. In some cases, there'd be some who'd come for the first day, the first set of 2-day practices, which was very hot fall that year, and it was, you know, almost 100 degrees on a few days, and just didn't come back again, and realized, I think, you know, this is a lot harder than it looks. I mean, that if you have to wear these pads, you're going to get hit, you're going to get knocked down, you're going to be tired, you're going to be sore, you're going to hurt, and some, you know, didn't have the same level of commitment as others. The players who stuck with it and made it through the season were really the ones who worked in the weight room over the summer, attended some various, you know, speed practices and agility practices and things to get them into shape, and then had so much more invested than a few of the others that they kept at it and really, I think, reaped the rewards and the lessons in the end.
I want to quote the book at one point when you say there was a difference. Coach Trost had already decided between the Shorewood kids and the Messmer kids. The Shorewood kids, for the most part, came from stable, two-parent families. They were reliable, dependable. They hardly ever missed practice or complained about it when they were there. Those from Messmer, while good kids, were dealing with so much more: absent fathers, working mothers, the allure of the street. While Maurice Ragsdale, the son of a single mother, picked up potato chips and pies for dinner at the gas station each night on the way home, Marty Wallner's mother baked cookies for the team, which she sent over on Fridays in old shoeboxes lined with aluminum foil. I mean, there is a summary not only of how maybe a typical Shorewood kid might be different from a typical Messmer kid, but how their families were different, how the mothers were different from each other. They were just living out different lives.
Yeah, they really were, and then were brought together for this, you know, several hours a day at practice and on the football field. And for me, that was one of the most intriguing questions about the team, even more so than the athletic side of how they would do on the field, but how would they do sort of as people and getting along and learning the sport and learning about each other. And the two mentioned there became good friends throughout the season. Later in the season, there's a point when Maurice, the player from Messmer, considers quitting the team, and Marty Wallner is right there after that game to say, no, you should come back. You've put too much into the season. And he does, and comes back and continues to play. And it was those sorts of things that you know, those two probably wouldn't have had any real reason to ever meet, but they did, and I think they both took something away from the other in terms of you know, lessons on the season and lessons about commitment or lessons about just their attitude toward the team.
As practices were getting underway with this team, and there was, at least to some extent, a real optimism in the air, as a somewhat objective observer, to what extent did you find yourself caught up in that same air of optimism?
Well, as I said before, I hadn't followed high school football that closely, I mean, other than just sort of passing interest in it. And I knew Shorewood's background was not as an athletic powerhouse. They had, for the previous years, had a record of something like 104-4, and that being reversed in terms of 4 victories and 104 losses. They had 2 very, very long losing streaks in there, one of 63 games, and I think the other one was like 38 games. So I knew they weren't a particularly successful program, which was one reason, of course, they were suffering declining numbers. It's a lot easier for students to, I think, go out on a team if they think there's going to be that tangible success of winning. But, you know, you went to the first practices and you see the sort of the players out there and how strong and athletic many of them were, how committed many of them were to the sport, and you kind of said, well, they got to do all right. And they their season, their schedule, they had some games that were very winnable. They almost won the second game. Their first game was against Whitefish Bay, which was one of the strongest schools in the area, and one of the toughest opponents they would face, and they really got pummeled in that game. And it was really a rude awakening for the players who went out thinking, you know, this is it, this is our chance. You know, the lights were on, you know, the stands, there's a lot of people out there watching us, the band is playing, there's the whole, everything you think about in terms of high school football was there, but that success at the end, and everyone realized how hard it was. A week later, they went to Lakeside Lutheran, which was in Lake Mills, Wisconsin, and they had a game where two, maybe three plays, had they gone in the opposite fashion, they would have won that game, and that would have probably set a very different tone for the rest of the season, because as the season went along, they played three or four very, very tough games, and then had the what were considered the easier games at the end with the players and teams in their own sort of ability level. The conference, the Parkland, has basically four teams that are very good and four that are not, and some go up and move down in a given year, but they had a chance on the stretch to win some of those last games, but didn't, and they actually finished the season without a victory, and which was where by the end, just from the writing perspective, it kept me interested, though, because it was always this idea that the next game is the game we're going to win.
And, well, and this increasingly desperate need for a win, and on all efforts focused towards that ultimately elusive goal. Let's talk for a minute about this whole issue of black and white students on the same football team. You talk about how when the first week of practice finished, first week, which you said was largely successful, you said, nevertheless, there was still a tentativeness between the players from the two schools that was tied into all the differences. During dinner breaks, they sat separately in the cafeteria, the starters mostly all to themselves, and that was another sort of set of divisions. Were they ever going to blend their talents together and become one, or were they going to split and splinter one school here, the other there? To what extent did a successful melding occur? And to whatever extent it did, how did that occur?
Yeah, I think it did occur, and it occurred gradually in just bits and pieces and incidents and things that went on. There was one case about a week or so into the season, a week and a half, where one of the there was some frustration, I think, by some players who were being asked to switch positions. Happened, and what everyone saw happen was there was two Messmer kids who went right after him to the locker room and said, "No, you need to come back. We need you on our team." It wasn't the Shorewood players, of course, wanted him back as well, but it was things like that where you saw, you know, gradually the idea building that we're on one team. It's not, at one point I write, it's not Shorewood Red or Messmer Blue, but you're on the same team. And as the season went on, I think the players began to realize that their opponents didn't make a lot of distinctions. They didn't, you know, look across the line and say, you know, this guy, he's a Shorewood player, and I think he's okay, but I don't like the Messmer side, or the reverse, that the Messmer guy's a good guy and I don't like those Shorewood players. They looked across the line of scrimmage and everybody's wearing the same jersey. They're all wearing the same helmets, the same uniform. That's one team, and they didn't make the distinction. And I think over time, the players on the team, you know, didn't make the distinction either. Toward the end of the season, there were jokes and people wanted to go to each other's homecoming dances, and you know, some of the players who didn't go to either kind of hung out themselves that night, and there really were some friendships that were made where I think some of them will last for a long time. One of the coaches would put it as, you know, if this guy is good enough to block for me, he's good enough to be my friend. You know, if he's good enough to you know, he has to catch my pass or throw the pass, you know, he's good enough, I can, you know, if, you know, if you rely on them in one spot, you can rely on them in another spot.
Mm. I thought you made such an interesting observation at one point in the book when you said, though few would ever admit it, it was a test for the Messmer players to arrive in Shorewood for practice every day. I mean, just because it was not on their home turf. They had to go to Shorewood for the practices. Most Mesmer players took the bus, while several from Shorewood had their own cars. When they went home at night, the Mesmer players faced stares for something as simple as waiting as a group at the bus stop.
Yeah, that was one of the dynamics there. Of course, was Shorewood had the football stadium, they had the team, they had the equipment, and so it had to be conducted at Shorewood. And that, and there were some events where the coaches tried to get the players to at Mesmer, so they would go back and forth over the summer. They lifted weights at the two places, and usually more so at Mesmer because they're. Weight facilities actually were a little newer and weren't in Shorewood. There's a community has some the community has some access to the weight room, so it was kind of hard to conduct a weightlifting workout there. But the players did, as I said early on, some had never been to Shorewood, and if you had a group of you know 5-6 Mesmer players, all African Americans, sitting at a bus stop, I mean, some people would kind of look over there and say, What's going on? And they wouldn't initially be seen as, well, that's part of the Shorewood Mesmer team. I think today when that goes on, hopefully there's a different perspective. But the players would talk about that. You know, they'd hang out at the bus stop or whatever and just, you know, go home as a group. In some cases, they would go as a unit and say they would get off. And, you know, some would get off at an earlier bus stop to make sure someone else got home safely or stuck as a group because where they were going wasn't often in the safest of neighborhoods. It was their home, but you know, they would wait. If someone had to transfer to another bus, they'd wait as a group for that person to get on that bus and get on safe and then move to the next house or the next person's house. And it was a real, you know, different background from where, you know, at Shorewood, some of the players lived just a block or two away from the school so they could walk home or certainly had a different home to go to.
When, of course, for some of these players, it was the Mesmer players, a reality would be that they had to drop the team to start a part-time job at the insistence of one or more of their parents because of some sort of reversal in the home economically or something. I mean, there were certain things like that that certainly weighed on their lives. And then, of course, there would also be certain cases of students that just didn't have the commitment to this undertaking or just did not understand what it really took to be on board 100%.
Right. In the book, I try to develop that theme a little bit in terms of the coach of sort of the tension that goes on between youth and adulthood. And the kids are in high school, so that's obviously a time when, you know, certainly when you're starting high school, you're 14 years old maybe, and you're leaving and you're ready to go off to college and get a job, and you're, you know, legally and technically an adult. And there's sort of these moments that go back and forth where some are faced with more adult questions earlier, whether it's having to get a job to help support the family, whether it's, you know, parents or grandparents who are sick that they're dealing with. And some of that took place on both sides. It's not a case where the Shorewood kids had just these glowing, perfect lives. But as a group, the Mesmer kids faced a lot more of those challenges. And the coaches, I think, looked at the season and said, you know, when you've got those problems, and this playing football ought to be a break from them, and can you leave those problems aside, you know, kind of draw a line around the football field and say, while you're playing, don't worry about them. You know, you can be a kid over here, even if when you leave and step across the line again and go home, that you have these other problems and issues to deal with. And some kids were able to do that, and others weren't. I think the problems just sort of got too heavy in some cases, and they left the team. One player had. It was his, I forget if it was his great-great-grandmother or his great-grandmother was quite ill, and she was the woman who had raised him. And he was dealing with this and trying to keep it to himself and still play football because he knew he had made a commitment to the team and was just really wrestling and struggling with these different commitments. Should his commitment be to his great-grandmother, or should his commitment be to his classmates and teammates? And in the end, he made the decision, I think, that was probably right for him, that he had to help his family. Mm. And that was the kind of thing that, you know, he really wrestled with it. And I think, you know, he certainly wanted to play, but he just at some point decided he couldn't any longer.
There's a very interesting moment at some point during the practices when there is a real dispute between head coach Trost and really the one and only coach that was over from the Messmer side, I think Coach Larson.
Right.
Am I right? They're having a dispute over a certain kind of drill, a really hard-hitting, demanding kind of drill that Coach Trost really liked to do, but Coach Larson began to think that it was being maybe done too much, or he was just pushing these young men past their physical limits and so on. And in the really honest, intense exchange between the two of them, Coach Larson says something about, "I have to be concerned about the safety of my guys." And Coach Trost's reply is really, in some ways, it encapsulates what this season was all about.
Right. His reply was, "They're not your guys, they're my guys too." And
this is the Shorewood Messmer team.
Right. And the coach, and that was, there was, you know, some tension in putting it together on a lot of levels. And the drills that were going on were what were called the Oklahoma drills, which are, they probably have different names at every team, but they're these two-on-two drills where there's two linemen who kind of go at it, and then the linebacker and a running back. And the idea is the running back, they run through this chute, and the running back tries to get past. The lineman wants to clear a space for when he gets past, and the linebacker has to tackle him. And they're a pretty intense drill, but they're also a necessary kind of drill because that really replicates what happens on the football field with every play. And it required the team to really get emotionally invested in it and focused on it, whereas some were intimidated by it. And the problem was, if you were intimidated by the drill and didn't go at it hard, that's when you were more likely to be hurt than if you really went at it. And some players were nervous about it. Some got hurt in the drill, and there was an exchange. I mean, that was a point where the coaches, too, had to realize we were in this together, and there was an exchange in the locker room about, well, are these drills too tough? Well, if we don't do them, are we going to be ready to play? At that point, they had a game in something like 10 or 11 days later against a very tough team. And if the players weren't able to function and get through the drill, how were they going to be able to get through the game? And the idea was, well, how hard can you push the team? If you don't push them hard enough, are they going to be ready? And if they're not ready, will they suffer a great loss and quit? Or if you push them too hard, will they walk away?
Or get hurt.
And it was really a line where it was hard to gauge where it was. And it was really a telling exchange that this was a case where, as a reporter, I was allowed to hang out and saw the whole thing. And it was got to the crux of the question, as you said.
It's fascinating, too, because, I mean, quite apart from the whole racial mix and so on of the team and this sort of unique situation, that, of course, is a challenge to any coach of any team, is how hard do I push these young athletes? Mm-hmm. How far is too far? On the other hand, when you have a team pulled from two such divergent populations as Messmer and Shorewood, then I suppose, in a sense, it becomes a still trickier challenge. How hard can I push these athletes, because they are such a mix? They're not all cut from the same cloth at all.
Right. It was a great challenge on so many levels, and I think the book, I mean, one reason I decided after the newspaper article ran that there's really a book here was there was just so much more depth and context to it, things that in the newspaper article may have only gotten a paragraph are fleshed out in much greater detail in the book. And that is one of the areas where, you know, high school in general is a rough time for kids, or can be. It's a very emotional time, and sports certainly are. And I think the book will appeal not just to high school sports fans, but anyone who's gone through high school. There's so many themes in there beyond sports. I've been saying it's a book about a high school football team, but it's not a book about football per se. It operates in so many other levels, and hopefully people will grasp onto that.
Absolutely. I was struck by all the small little details that could be applied to other football teams and other kinds of teams and other kinds of endeavors that have nothing to do with football at all or athletics at all. For instance, there's real turbulence at the position of quarterback all season long. And at one point, when it looks like a young man named Micah is going to be the quarterback, at least for a while, and they're working with him in practice, and he's just way too tight. And his older brother, Mark, who's the star running back, is trying to get him to relax, but he just can't. And you say at one point, it's easy to say relax, but it is one of those things. The more you are told to relax, the harder it is to relax. And, of course, for young athletes, eager to do well, trying so hard, sometimes their own effort gets in their own way and prevents them from executing the way that they want to.
Right, and that was a case where Micah was the third, I think, quarterback at that point, and the week before, the quarterback, Ronnell Halbert, was really their strongest receiver, so he had to get back to receiver, and they had some chance to work with Micah, and the team really rallied around him to the point where, you know, he did get much more confident as the season went on, and it's a lot of those little stories of personal growth for some of the players that really made it a rewarding thing. I felt by the end of the season that I had gotten to know a lot of these the players as people, and that they just have great character, and that this season will serve them in so many ways, in ways they probably don't even realize now, but someday in the future they'll be able to reach back and draw on the experiences they had, whether it's as simple as getting in front of a group someday and having to give a speech and not be nervous about it, or to have to be thrust in a situation where this complete teamwork is required and being able and willing to do it.
One of the things that's mentioned early on is the movie Remember the Titans with Denzel Washington, which tells, at least in some respects, I haven't seen the movie yet, but sort of tells a similar story of the coming together of different kinds of students onto a single football team and going on to great, great success. And, of course, the hope is, by so many, that this Shorewood Messmer team will follow a similar story. But as you say, at one point after the last game, if life was a movie, the tears would have been tears of joy. If life was a movie, they would have won this game. Life is not a movie. Most emphatically, life was not a movie for the young athletes on this team.
Right, and that was, people have said, well, why would you get so enamored with or interested in a team that didn't win? And my response is always, that's so much more realistic. I mean, that's the way life is. And they remember the Titans movie, that the two schools, it's set in the late 60s or early 70s in the Virginia area, and the two schools merge into one, the entire school, and the team is very successful. I mean, they win every game. And this is not that team, but it has carried some of the same themes to it. And, I try to frame it in the book as, what is the measure of success in sports? For some teams, the measure of success is never falling. And in other teams, it's about once you do fall, always getting back up. And this is that team, the one who always gets back up. And they were rewarded, quite frankly, in their second season where they won three games, and that's covered in the epilogue where the new coach, Ron Davies, who was formerly of Kenosha Tremper, so he's well known in these parts, came in and they won three games in that second year, which still may not seem like much, but for that program, it was the most Shorewood had won in going back, I think, 16, 17 years. And that's something that they're building on now to get even better down the road.
Coach Trost ends up resigning and after this season is concluded. And the perception by some is that if he had not resigned, he would have been dismissed. Give us some sense of how you think he and his staff did in this effort. I mean, they certainly put their heart and soul into it. but with not a single victory in the end to show for it. How much of this is their responsibility?
Well, I think they did very well with what they were faced with, and the same way the success for the players is in always getting back up, the coaches always got back up and they stuck at it and stuck with it. I mean, the whole idea of the team was, at least who presented it and got it rolling, was Coach Trost, who now is coaching at, I believe, Horicon High School, and they had a good season last year, another improving team. This team had many, many challenges, and the measure of success, I think, for them was, you know, not where they finished, but how much progress they made from where they began. At the end of the season, the coach tells the players, you know, 0-9 isn't on your record, it's on my record. You know, when you are playing, you know, when you're 20 years from now, you're at your high school reunion and you're talking about football, you shouldn't remember 0-9. And I believe that, and I even more so having finished the book, that, and if you look in high school yearbooks for the Shorewood team or many other high schools out there, they're going to be these 0-9 seasons or 1-11 or 1-8 or these seasons that on the surface, if they're reduced to that number, you look at it and you say, well, that was a horrible season. But the lessons and what went into this season are so much greater than that 0-9 that I think it's something they can all take great pride in.
One interesting phenomenon is that at a place like Shorewood, where the football program, for whatever reason or multitude of reasons, was really evaporating, I mean, in terms of numbers, I mean, it's unlike so many other high schools, a football player was not the focus of attention, was not the great hero. You mentioned at one point about how the Shorewood homecoming court had absolutely no football players on it. It was just, and some would even sort of jokingly say that the football program mostly existed so the band would have some place to play. It's really odd to imagine a high school in America where football would have that sort of tangential place in everybody's focus.
Right. I mean, what happened over time as there were these long losing streaks there and seasons that were very difficult, and you know, lots of coaches who came and went, was, you know, the fans, there is still great support in Shorewood for the football team. If you go to the games, there's always, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people there. A lot of community members and people with no, you know, kids in school right now will still go to the games and support the team, but they sort of, you know, you'd hear these resounding cheers because they got a first down. I mean, you know, in some cases they would cheer the first downs as much as other schools would cheer a touchdown. So there's this different way to look at how the team is successful. And, you know, it would be the sort of, well, you played hard, you gave it your all, you know, way to go. And that's true. But players and just as people, you look at that and you say, well, my success is if I won the game, or my success is if I scored a touchdown, you know. And it's hard, especially in the emotion of the season, to look at that and say, well, yeah, this was a great success. Now that you've had the players and others of it a little time to look back at it, to see it perhaps a little differently, I think they realize there is some great success to be found in that season.
Mm. It must have been very interesting for you to follow this team, its athletes and its coaches, in the aftermath of several of these losses, which were disastrous losses. I mean, I remember one of them was 64-0, and a number of the games were shutouts, lopsided shutouts. Mm-hmm. And it must have been interesting for you to observe coaches and athletes trying to pick up the pieces time and time again.
Right. It was interesting, and it was at times very difficult. I mean, I would always, the games are generally always on a Friday night, and there was one, I think, on a Saturday afternoon. But they would always have these workouts on Saturday morning that weren't really just running and exercise to stay in shape. And the players, if they got there before the coaches, they'd wait on kind of a stoop out near the Shorewood Gymnasium and sit around and talk about the game. And even though they knew what I was doing and therefore why I was coming, it was hard several times to get in my car and just go, like, thinking, I don't want to experience that again. I mean, you just see this shattered look on the face of some of the players, or this real downcast thing. And it was always a real test to say, well, who's going to get them motivated? What's going to get them refocused on this week? And that was, there was always, as I mentioned, the idea that, well, next, this coming week, that's where we're going to win. And even down to the last game in week 9, where it was a game they could have won, and it was very close going into the locker room at halftime. And I'm, as a reporter, sitting there still not knowing what is the story that I'm following. Is it the underdog that finally has its day, or is it, you know, something quite different?
One last devastating.
And my editors were quite interested in just, what is this story you're writing, and why have you been out there every day? And I thought you said they were going to win some games. And
you know, it's so interesting. It reminds all of us that we so seldom follow the loser with this sort of intensity. I mean, just like on ABC, I mean, the little up-close and personal vignettes are all about Michelle Kwan and Tara Lipinski. Mm-hmm. They're not about the struggling skater that finishes 20th. I mean, we don't know anything about them, and we tend to know very little about the teams that are at the bottom of their respective divisions. This is a chance for us to be inside of a team mightily struggling to achieve any kind of tangible success whatsoever. We just don't get to look at those teams very often in this kind of detail.
Right, and I think, you know, for the most, I mean, more teams probably are closer to this team than to the perfect season or the championship season. And I've always found that the more compelling stories are in cases like this. I mean, Michelle Kwan and some others probably have some obstacles they overcame and determination to become a champion and all that, and that's interesting in its own right. But we see that all the time. Back when I started out at Marion, Indiana, it was 5 years at that point from a state championship basketball team, and in Indiana, basketball is everything, and this team had won 2 or 3 in a row. And the editors were putting together a story about what happened to the other players, and I was asked to help out, and they're asking, well, who gets what player to deal with? And, you know, and they thought there's going to be this debate over who gets which of the stars and what they're doing now. And I said, I'll take the bench warmers, because I want to talk to the person who, in that case, maybe the highlight of their sports life was being able to say they were on this team, and now they're, you know, into more obscurity or something they didn't get to go live and pursue it on, because that's, to me, a more interesting story than the person who's successful all the time. We have all kinds of models like that. We have a lot fewer of teams that are not successful on the field in the victory column, but are successful in life, and I think there's a little more for people to take away from in those cases.
Mm-hmm. Two last quick questions, and I know we need to let you go. Did you think about changing names? I'm assuming you didn't change names, that these are real names of
right,
everybody involved. Because, and I should say, as we read this book, we're not only learning about the inspiring stories of young men like Nate Shorter, who show up and are determined and are there all the way through, and you get done and you just want to give them a hug for hanging in there so well. But we also hear about all kinds of other students that throw it in, throw their helmets, stalk off the field, and never come back. And you're very honest about everybody's story here. I wonder, did you ever seriously consider disguising the identity of these young people and these stories which you told so honestly?
Briefly, but I didn't really pursue that angle. I think it's sometimes harder than if you have some that have different names and some that have their real names, and people who are familiar with the team are already familiar with the story. And it's in some cases, if someone had no interest in being in the thing at all, you couldn't just write a, you know, player X kind of thing. That I think by just treating it straightforwardly, but being you know, fair to all involved, and several other people who are in the book and have read it now have said it's very fair. And one was related to me. The father of actually Marty Wallner, who we mentioned earlier, had said, you know, he was reading some of the sections to his family when they got the book, and he said, Marty said, you know, that's exactly how it happened, meaning not just it was factually correct, but it had the tenor of what happened and the emotion of what happened. And
that's how it
to
felt.
Me, that's exactly, that's the greatest compliment, that it, A, is fair, and B, reflects how it happened. And I think people will be satisfied with that.
So by and large, this has been well received by the people whose stories are told here.
Yeah, so far. And I think I haven't talked with everyone yet. There is a good event on Sunday, which is a good chance to give a brief
yes.
plug to it. Sunday the 7th at Messmer High School in Milwaukee, 742 West Capitol Drive. The two schools are sponsoring or co-hosting a book release party where the books that are sold that day will go to help the team. A lot of the former players and current players are expected or have been invited. So I'm looking forward to that, to get a chance to see some of the players again, a few who are away at college, maybe coming in to participate. And everyone who's, I haven't heard any bad reactions to the book. Now, I suppose at some point I'll get a bad review somewhere and I'll say, well, what are they talking about? What are they? Yeah. But that's part of what goes on. And I think, you know, people, for the most part, have liked it. It's gotten some very positive reviews in the ones that have been done, and quite a bit of interest because it is such a compelling story that I think now, after a couple years from the removed from the season itself, that people can see the success that they had and see it in a different light perhaps than they did right after the season concluded.
When is that event on Sunday?
It's on Sunday. I'm sorry. It's at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Messmer High School. And it's a great chance to see some of the players, get a book, and it'll be right at Messmer, where it's just my alma mater, so that's why they're hosting it.
Very good. The book, again, is called First and Long, A Black School, a White School, and Their Season of Dreams, published by Badger Books. There's a foreword by Vince Lombardi, Jr., and the author is Greg Borowski. Greg Borowski, I congratulate you. I loved this book. I enjoyed it so much, and I hope that many people will seek it out and enjoy it as I did. And Greg Borowski, we appreciate you in your busy schedule making time for us on the morning show today.
Oh, thank you very much.
You can hear my complete interview with Greg Borowski in the podcast version of The Morning Show. And by the way, earlier this year, Greg Borowski, still with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, was named the paper's executive editor. And the screening of the documentary film Messwood is at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow evening in the Rita Talent Picken Regional Center for the Arts and Humanities. I'm Gregory Berg. It's 8:59, and coming up on Monday's morning show, a new interview I recorded with Ahmed White, author of Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies, and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. The term Wobblies refers to members of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, a union that was formed in 1905 to try and reshape the brutal experience of industrial workers in the U.S. in the early 20th century. The book chronicles how the union was systematically destroyed by its opponents. The weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois calls for intermittent rain showers on and off all day long, with a high temperature today of 65 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 45. And then tomorrow, Saturday, a return of sunshine, again a high of 65. Sunday warming to 69. Monday into the low 70s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.